You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity, and we're coming to the end of an administration and the beginning of a new one, and that means pardons are in the air. Well, you might wonder, because the Constitution doesn't say that much about pardons, just that the power of the pardon shall be that of the president. Well, how far does that power really go? Well, we spoke to an expert on pardons some time back, and we thought this was an excellent time to replay some of the things that she told us about the history and the power of the pardon. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll be back next week with a new episode. Podcast today is part explainer, part history on the presidential authority to grant pardons for national security offenses and the history of clemency and pardons generally to give us some context. Because we are, after all, coming to the end of one administration. We're in pardon season.
Joining us today is Helen Bulwark, the woman who was deputy chief of section of the Department of Justice known as the Pardon Attorney Office for long enough that she became the department's leading expert, a description she is too humble to accept. Former pardon attorneys have lauded her knowledge of the history of pardons and the law, so we're excited to welcome Helen Bulwark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm glad to be here, and it's a particularly appropriate day, I guess, because President Trump just pardoned the Thanksgiving turkey again. That happened, I think, within the last half hour. I don't know whether it was corn or cob that got pardoned, but the turkey pardon was today. I have to say, having spent 19 years of my 35 years in the Justice Department, 19 years in the pardon attorney's office, the turkey pardon is not my favorite event because to me it kind of makes a joke out of clemency. And those of us who work in the clemency arena really do think that it's a much more important power than the turkey pardon leads people to believe. But it's an auspicious day, I guess.
Well, that's a great lead into what we'd love to talk to you about, Helen, which is the law. Just foundationally, what grants the president the authority to grant pardons and what limitations are placed on that authority?
Well, the pardon power is granted to the president by the Constitution in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, which states that the president, quote, shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. 20 words. That's it. That is the entire grant of the pardon power to the president, with no other qualifiers and no other explanations around it. So it's an extremely broad power. It is the one power that the president has absolute plenary authority to exercise, and he can exercise it in any fashion he chooses. So what does that mean? Well, the language says it applies to offenses against the United States. That means federal offenses, not state offenses. If a person is convicted in the state of New York or the state of Maryland or the state of California for something and wants to come to the president for a pardon, we have to say, sorry, go to your governor. The president cannot help you. It also means that the president's power does not extend to civil infractions or penalties. So if you're convicted of federal tax evasion, the president can pardon you. If the IRS says, we've audited you and you owe us $100,000 and we're going to put on top of that penalties and interest in a civil setting, you come to the pardon attorney, we say, sorry, the president can't help you. So civil penalties are excluded. Federal criminal penalties are pardonable. The other thing that obviously the president can't do under the language of the Constitution is that he cannot pardon an impeachment, someone who is being impeached. That's the only limitation that the founding fathers put on the pardon power. At the time that the pardon clause was drafted and debated during the Constitutional Convention and the ratification efforts in the new states, there was a big debate. Should treason be pardonable? Should we exclude that as an offense that the president cannot touch? Should the Senate have to consent to a pardon, particularly in cases of treason? Maybe the Senate, you should have to get the advice and consent of the Senate as he does with appointments. What remedy would exist if a president abuses the power? How do we handle a president who pardons co-conspirators for a crime in which he participated? And there is actually some historical record on what the founding fathers thought on this. It's not nearly as robust as a number of the other provisions in the Constitution, but they did debate it to some degree back and forth, and particularly Alexander Hamilton. The upshot of all of this debate was that they decided that treason should be a pardonable offense and impeachment's not. Excluding impeachment was the right way to handle what kind of an exception should exist. Treason, they actually felt it would probably be, at least Alexander Hamilton, it would be a good idea to be able to pardon treasons, because a well-considered pardon in that kind of circumstance might forestall or end a civil war. And there were, after all, in our history, instances in which presidents granted pardons of treason for that very reason. The second question they decided was, should the president be able to act alone without the consent of the Senate? They said, yes, president acts alone. Senate cannot restrain or circumscribe his pardon power. And what remedy did they believe that the president should be available for a president who abuses the pardon power or conspires with others to break the federal law? The remedy, they said, was the House of Representatives can always impeach him and the Senate can try him and he can be removed from office. That was the remedy that they proposed that would be adequate. So that's what pardon power came to be in the Constitution. It encompasses a number of different kinds of pardon, of clemency. The broad term is clemency, but that includes pardons or full pardons. Generally, pardons in today's context are pardons after completion of sentence. But I'll get to this in a little bit later, but it doesn't have to be after completion of sentence. So a president can pardon, he can commute a sentence, which means he can shorten a sentence that's being served. He can grant a reprieve of a sentence, in other words, delay its execution. Presidents have done that often in death sentence cases. And the president can remit unpaid financial punishments that are part of a sentence. So if a person is sentenced not only to prison, but also to pay a $20,000 fine, that can be remitted by the president, either in the context of a commutation or by a pardon. And the Department of Justice actually has opined, the Office of Legal Counsel has opined that the president's pardon power also can extend to remissions. So remissions of restitution could be granted by the president. There's another category that writers on the topic talk about generally. They talk about amnesty. Amnesty is just pardons of a group. So it's generally proclamations that extend to a group of people rather than an individual person. But generally, the two things that we think about are pardon, commutation of sentence, reprieve, and remission of fine or restitution. So what is the effect of a pardon? There are a lot of misconceptions about that. A pardon in modern day parlance is an expression of the president's forgiveness for committing a crime. And it removes the civil disabilities that flow from that conviction. One of the many reasons, or one of the most popular reasons people apply for federal pardons over the time that I was in the pardon attorney's office and continuing on to this day, I'm sure, is to remove their federal firearms disabilities, to get their firearms rights back. But also, it restores your right to vote. It restores your right to hold office if these disabilities flow from the fact of your federal conviction. And a lot of people also apply to the president for pardon if they want to seek licensure in a profession, either for the first time or if they're seeking to be reinstated and they've been banned from the profession because of their conviction. They come to the pardon attorney and ask the president to pardon them so that they can go back to the licensing authority and say, look, I'm rehabilitated. The president has granted me a pardon to show that I'm rehabilitated. He believes me. You should take that into account when you're considering my reapplication. Now, the pardon doesn't require the licensing board to do that. Some early language in Supreme Court talked about the pardon blotting out guilt and making it as if it had never happened. That's not true. And that's the Supreme Court almost immediately backed away from that as too broad a statement. But like I said, the person who is seeking reinstatement can say, look, take this pardon into account, shows that the president believes that I am a good risk, that I am rehabilitated. But it doesn't, he can't take it to the pardon or to the licensing board and say, okay, I got a pardon, you have to let me back in. That doesn't work that way. The other misconception that people have is that the pardon expunges the record of conviction. A commutation obviously wouldn't, because that just shortens your sentence. But a lot of people think that a pardon expunges your conviction. And a lot of writers, when they write about, oh, the president pardoned somebody, you know, he's erased the conviction. It's like it never happened. That's not true either. And the Supreme Court case law makes that clear. What happens when a person is pardoned is that the pardon attorney's office, when they handle the paperwork for the pardon, they notify the FBI that the person has been pardoned, and their criminal history record is updated to show both the conviction and the pardon. But it's not as though the FBI takes the pardon and then just removes the conviction from his record. So it is not an automatic rewriting of history. It's a statement that you've been rehabilitated. And for that reason, the pardon attorney's office makes it clear to people that when you come seeking a pardon, you shouldn't be looking for vindication, because normally a pardon is not a statement of vindication. Every so often, an executive, a governor, or very occasionally a president will issue a pardon and say, you know, I believe this person is innocent. And I honestly can't think of a president that's done that, although at one point I tried to look that up and I saw something in a record that said it had been like in the middle 80s that had happened, but I don't know with who. But generally speaking, a pardon is an expression of forgiveness. It's not a statement of innocence, and it's not a vindication. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there about what a pardon does and doesn't do.
Well, that is a wonderful start. Given the kind of the contours of what the limitations are and how it's essentially plenary, mm-hmm. Has there ever been a grant of a pardon that's been subject of a controversy that's been litigated in federal court?
Oh yeah, there's actually a pretty robust body of case law about the clemency power and pardons, and particularly in the Supreme Court, beginning in the 19th century, there's a fair number of cases that talk about what the pardon power is and isn't. And first of all, it's very clear from Supreme Court case law that Congress cannot limit the president's authority to pardon. Supreme Court said that as early as 1866 in Ex parte Garland, which was also the case that talked about it blotting out guilt. But even though they've retreated from that, the fact that Congress cannot circumscribe the power is very, very clear. The court reaffirmed that in a number of other cases, including Schick versus Reed, where they held that was a case involving a military death sentence. And the question was whether or not the fact that, Furman versus Georgia had been decided meant that, you know, the death penalty couldn't go forward. The court talked a lot about the power of the court and the power of the legislature to limit the president's pardon power. And the court held again that the president's pardon power cannot be modified, abridged, or diminished by any statute. In other cases where the court has considered clemency, they've talked repeatedly about how that is an area that the court should be, you know, very reluctant to even look at, because it's outside of their authority. The pardon power is solely the president's. It's not one that's subject to the merits are not subject to judicial review. Another thing that has been litigated is whether or not the pardon can be at what point the pardon can be exercised. And the Supreme Court has made it clear, again, as far back as Ex parte Garland, that the president can exercise his power anytime after the federal offense has been committed. You don't have to have been indicted. You don't have to have gone to trial. You don't have to have been sentenced. The president can pardon you as soon as you've committed the crime. What the president can't do, though, is pardon prospectively. In other words, he can't absolve you before you've committed the crime. That's the one thing that the power does not extend to. It has to be a completed act. So if you've committed a crime and the president is aware of it and wants to forgive you for it, doesn't matter if you've been found out and indicted and tried, the pardon would be just as valid at that point. Best example of that, obviously, is the Nixon pardon. When Nixon left office, the country was in quite a turmoil over Watergate and his role in Watergate and all of the things that had happened. And President Ford made the decision to pardon Nixon for any federal offense he might have committed while in office. Very broad language, but kind of necessary because I don't think anybody knew at that point what the full catalog was. And Ford's purpose in that, of course, was to try and put an end to Watergate, put it behind the country, and let us move forward. There is often a political calculus in the exercise of clemency. Ford made the decision that was the thing to do. Many people think that he paid a heavy price for that in the subsequent election in 1976, where he was defeated, because it was an extremely controversial grant of pardon. The president's pardon power also includes, they've said, the power to commute sentences and the power to set conditions on commutations or pardons. So a president can grant either a full and unconditional pardon, or he can include a condition that has to be met by the petitioner before the pardon becomes effective. When President Ford established his clemency board in the mid-70s, for military deserters and some people who had been convicted of violating the Military Selective Service Act, he set up a system whereby they were granted conditional pardons and initially, and they then had to complete terms of alternative service. And once they had completed the alternative service, that would be certified by either the military branch head, if you were a military person, or by the Selective Service Act head, if it was a military Selective Service Act draft evader, and then the pardon would become effective. And at that point, they were issued a full and complete pardon. So initially, the pardon was made conditional. It became final once they had satisfied the condition. One of the most famous examples of a conditional clemency grant that was litigated and sort of ended in the middle was Jimmy Hoffa's commutation for his convictions of fraud in dealing with the Teamsters pension fund. And he was convicted, actually he was convicted in two different cases, one for jury tampering and one for various kinds of fraud related to the Teamsters pension fund. And he was sentenced to a 13-year sentence. He applied for a commutation. When the commutation application was reported up to the White House, John Dean, who was the counsel to the president at the time, suggested to the president that he include a condition that the commutation be granted on the condition that Hoffa not engage in any management or involvement with any union until March of 1980, when his prison sentence would have naturally expired. And that was the way the commutation was drafted and issued and granted and accepted by Hoffa. And then later on, he decided he didn't like that condition too much. So he went to court to fight it and claim that the condition violated his rights of free speech and free association. And in a very famous opinion in the district court, federal district court in the District of Columbia, Hoffa versus Saxby, the court went through a lengthy analysis of clemency and the president's ability to impose conditions on clemency and ruled that condition was appropriate. It was not a violation of his constitutional rights, and the president was fully within his power to add it to the commutation. Hoffa then apparently was planning on, and I don't know how far he got with it, planning to appeal that decision. And then, of course, as we know, Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. So the case was never appealed up to the for decision to the D.C. Circuit. And Hoffa versus Saxby still stands as a seminal case on the president's ability to impose conditions on a grant of clemency. President's power to grant clemency or pardon also extends to criminal contempts of court, but not civil contempts of court. That rule was announced in the Supreme Court's case of Ex parte Grossman in 1925. It's not a case that people think often about and probably hadn't thought about it for years until Joe Arpaio's situation came up earlier in the Trump administration, and President Trump granted him a full pardon before he had been convicted on the criminal contempt conviction. And that was a perfectly legitimate use of his power. People can disagree with it. There are a lot of reasons why they would, but it's perfectly legitimate under Ex parte Grossman. But the president's pardon power obviously does not extend to civil contempt, because civil contempt is not a crime. It is a coercive effort to try and force somebody to do something, to enforce the rights of a third party. Another case that people talk about and disagree about is the case of Burdick versus the United States, which talks about how pardon carries with it an imputation of guilt, and that acceptance of a pardon then is a confession of guilt. It does say that, and the Supreme Court's decision on that still stands, but there's a lot of debate about that nowadays, particularly if people are seeking pardon and then going out and saying, really, this shows that I was right all the time. It's a vindication of my point. And so a lot of people debate about whether you have to actually accept responsibility or confess guilt in order for a pardon to be effective. I will say that when a person applies for pardon, one of the things that the pardon attorney's office looks for, and it says so right on their website, which is incredibly fulsome and helpful to people. It has just a wealth of information about clemency and how to apply for clemency and what clemency means. We look at acceptance of responsibility. I mean, if you're coming to the president for forgiveness and to demonstrate rehabilitation, really acceptance of responsibility is the baseline for doing that. And of course, that flows from Burdick's language. It's basically an acceptance, confession of your guilt for the offense. Last case I would mention, this is not a Supreme Court case, but these days it's not as current as it was. It's a 1990 case out of the Third Circuit, but it expressly talks about how a pardon does not expunge a conviction. So again, people that come seeking a pardon thinking this is going to blot it all out and rewrite my criminal history, it doesn't do that. And this case is United States versus Noonan. So there's a very robust body of case law out there that people can look at if they're interested. You could start and go for days just reading these cases, because a lot of them are 19th century cases and they kind of go on in flowery terms. But the basic points still stand today.
Well, I have to say, I do like that sort of Baroque and detailed writing of some of those old opinions. I just wish that modernly we had the time to peruse them. But I mean, my head is just racing listening to you, that it sounds like, you know, the president, if he desired to do so, could, well within his constitutional authority at pretty much any time, pardon anybody working for him now. And I have not heard anything from what you've said that said that there's any constitutional limitation on him obviously pardoning himself, which has been a lot of the discourse. But I'll let you answer that in maybe in the context of your answer to the next question. But it's hard to imagine, although I know you're not in the office of the pardon attorney right now, but it's hard to imagine that all of this that we've been reading about in the news does actually clear the pardon attorney office at the Department of Justice, but it may, and maybe we just don't understand that. So if you could describe and educate our listeners on the normal process for seeking pardons, the role the Department of Justice plays in that, and why the Justice Department would even be involved in this when it's such an expansive grant of authority under Article 2?
Sure. Let me start with an important point that everybody needs to understand. The Pardon Attorney's Office operates under regulations that are promulgated in the Code of Federal Regulations. It's 28 CFR sections 1.1 to 1.11, 1.1 to 111. And they set forth the baseline requirements of how we process cases. The last section of that, of 1.111, makes it clear that those regulations are advisory only, and that they are for the guidance of the Department of Justice, the Office of the Pardon Attorney, but they do not constrain the president in any way, shape, or form. The president can exercise his authority without even talking to the Justice Department, without even letting the Justice Department know that he's going to do something until he wants the piece of paper to make it work. Because the Constitution does not require him to have a pardon attorney's office. The pardon attorney's office, or the role of the Justice Department in clemency, goes back to the mid 19th century and developed over time. There was a clerk of pardons, and when the Justice Department was established, the clerk of pardons was in that office, and the attorney general actually was in charge of the process. The State Department had actually been involved in it as well before that. The purpose of the pardon attorney's office is to give the president a good, full, complete, factual analysis of the case so that he is acting not in the dark, so that he has a full understanding of what the offense was and who the person is. That said, he doesn't have to ask for that. He can make his decision based on a Hollywood, person calling him up and saying, I think this would be a great idea if you would pardon X, or if you would commute the sentence of Y. And President Trump is not the only person who's done that. I mean, there have been situations going back to other presidents as well. It's a personal power of the president. The pardon attorney's office exists to make him, to make it easier for the president, and to be a funnel, really, for people who want to seek the president's clemency, so that they can come to us and we can process their paperwork, look into the case, and then report to the president what we found. And if a person wants to apply for clemency in a federal case, they go to the Office of the Pardon Attorney's website, which is at usdoj.gov/pardon. And there they will find the application forms for seeking a pardon, seeking a commutation of sentence. They're fully explained there. All of the rules for applying are explained. And, they have an entire section on frequently asked questions. All of the regulations are there. All of the policies of the department are there. And a person is not required to have a lawyer. It's meant to be user-friendly so that people can apply on their own. But there are a couple of eligibility requirements. But they govern what the pardon attorney's office will process. They do not constrain the president. The first eligibility requirement is that if a person is seeking a pardon for a federal case or for a federal conviction, they have to have satisfied a 5-year waiting period from the time of their release from any kind of confinement, or if there was no confinement, including home confinement, they just got a straight probation or a fine, then it's 5 years from the date of sentencing. But there's this 5-year waiting period, and the purpose for that has always been to give the person an opportunity to demonstrate a pattern of rehabilitation. It's much better to be able to show, here's what I've been doing for the last 5 years. This is why I'm rehabilitated, why I'm a good risk, why the president should, in his mercy, reach out and grant me clemency. If a person wants to apply for a commutation of sentence, which is obviously on a sentence they are actively serving, they cannot be challenging that sentence in court. So if they've got a pending appeal, if they've got a pending collateral attack, the pardon attorney's office will say, come back to us when these court proceedings have been completed if you still want to seek clemency. Really, I mean, it doesn't do anybody any good to have two tracks going on, one in the court and one with the president. So those are the eligibility requirements. They fill out the paperwork, they fill out the application forms, and they send them to the pardon attorney. A pardon application is required to be supported by affidavits from three witnesses who aren't members of the person's family, who know the person well and are willing to swear before a notary that they believe that they're good candidates for clemency. The paperwork really requires that the person account for everything he's done since the time of the conviction. And it's pretty long and pretty detailed, but you know, it's meant to give a full picture of who the person is. Once the pardon attorney's office receives the application, if the person meets the eligibility requirements, then they go and get the basic court paperwork that is needed to assess the case, the pre-sentence report, the judgment of conviction. They also look at court opinions. If it's a case that got some newspaper press, they'll look at those too to get a fuller picture of the conviction. After looking over all of that, if it's a case that looks like it might have some merit, they will then ask the FBI to do an FBI background investigation of the person. And that, of course, takes a fair amount of time. It's not unlike what the FBI does doing a background investigation of someone who is applying for a federal position, federal job. But basically, they go and talk to the applicant. They talk to his neighbors and his employers and goes back through his criminal history, basically to see, you know, what kind of a person is he and what is his criminal history. They'll report that to the pardon attorney. Then the pardon attorney, if that looks good, will go to the U.S. attorney and the sentencing judge and ask for their input. And once all of that information has been assembled, then the Office of the Pardon Attorney, the staff attorney and the pardon attorney in consultation will make a recommendation, draft a recommendation that goes to the president, but it goes through the deputy attorney general. So the letter of advice is what it's called, and it goes up to the deputy attorney general. The deputy attorney general reviews it, decides if he's comfortable with the recommendation. If not, he or she can tell the pardon attorney's office, I don't agree with this for whatever reason, you need to change it. And then it goes to the White House. And at the White House, it goes to the White House counsel's office, and they then review it and you know, make their recommendation to the president of what they think should happen. That's exactly what happened with Jimmy Hoffa when John Dean got the pardon attorney's recommendation. He said, well, I think we ought to add this condition. And so the condition got added. Hadn't come from the Justice Department. It came from the White House counsel. So, you know, there's discussion within the White House, too. And then the president makes his decision. And it doesn't matter what anybody else has recommended. In the end, the president makes his own call. And if he wants to pardon the person, he will pardon the person. You know, people get pardoned that other people didn't agree was a good idea. And some people get denied that other people think, gee, this person should be pardoned. But at the end of the day, it's the president's decision. And it, roughly the same process happens with a commutation. The person applies for commutation of sentence. The pardon attorney gets the pre-sentence report and judgment of conviction. No need for an FBI background investigation because, after all, we know where the person has been since they've been convicted. And we look at the case and make a recommendation up through the deputy attorney general to the president. In terms of standards that are applied, I mentioned earlier that acceptance of responsibility and remorse are important in the pardon context, and candor is always important, whether it's commutation or pardon. I mean, the applicant really needs to be honest about what the facts are. In a pardon case, the pardon attorney's office also looks at the seriousness and recency of the crime, the need for relief. You know, somebody may be applying because they really want to get back into nursing, or they want to get back into being a lawyer, or they want to get back into being a CPA, whatever it is. So if they have a need, that's something that obviously is important. And then the official recommendations by the sentencing judge and the U.S. attorney. In terms of commutations, typically and historically, the reasons why those have been granted over decades and decades have involved not only the seriousness of the offense and the person's overall criminal history,
and the length of time they've already served. But we also look at things like, is the sentence unduly severe, or is there a disparity between this person's sentence for this crime and what a lot of other people have gotten? So disparity and undue severity of sentence have always been an important issue in commutations. President Obama, of course, that was a real driver for the Obama Clemency Initiative, looking at mandatory minimum sentences at the end of his administration. Critical illness or old age of the applicant, reasons why commutations have been granted in the past, and unrewarded cooperation, perhaps, by the applicant. If a person has cooperated with the government in other investigations or other cases, but for one reason or another, a Rule 35 motion for reduction of sentence is not something that can be done at that time. So those are traditional reasons or standards that the Office of the Pardon Attorney looks at. But again, at the end of the day, it's the president's decision. The Justice Department recommends, the president decides, and he is not constrained by anything anybody tells him. He can make the decision on his own. He can make it with our input or without our input. And I think, you know, it's not a secret, because it's been said by this White House a number of times, and it's certainly been written about, that the president has acted in a number of situations solely on his own. And he can do that. He absolutely can.
When you talk about standards and acceptance, I mean, fugitivity is hard to reconcile with an acceptance of responsibility, because it's like you're avoiding responsibility. I'm thinking of Mark Rich, presently Edward Snowden. So I wonder if you could talk about those and maybe some of the other more controversial national security folks who have been either pardoned or discussed as possible subjects of pardon.
Well, again, this really goes to, this is the president's power. The Justice Department historically felt that fugitivity disentitled you to ask for anything. And so, you know, it was always the department's policy that if someone wanted something from the government, either, you know, their case to be dismissed or whatever, clemency, you had to come back to the United States, subject yourself to the court, and then, you know, we would talk about it. Mark Rich was a complete aberration from that. And, you know, that was the president's decision. That was his call. It's the whole Mark Rich, Pincus Green, who was his partner, pardon grant was exhaustively explored in congressional hearings after the end of the Clinton administration. And it's no secret, because it was testified to by the pardon attorney and also by the Deputy Attorney General, that application did not go through the Justice Department. Mark Rich was represented by Jack Quinn, who had been President Clinton's counsel to the president. And, you know, it was directly addressed to the president. And again, this is not secret, because the pardon attorney testified to it. The first time the pardon attorney's office knew about Mark Rich's pardon was when, in the middle of the night on January 19th to 20th, his name showed up on a list that we got from the White House. And then we had to figure out, who is this guy? We had no time to do anything other than put his name on the list. I mean, this was highly irregular. But again, the fact that he was a fugitive, to the department in its historic policy, we would have said that disqualifies you from seeking clemency. To the president, doesn't matter. If he believes that that was the right thing to do, and apparently the pitch that was made to the president was, the prosecution is extreme, you know, they've charged him with unfair offenses, and, you know, this is kind of a, I won't use the term witch hunt, because that term has just gotten overused, but this was prosecutorial excess. And apparently President Clinton accepted that. Now, and, you know, when the congressional hearings happened, it turned out that Mark Rich's ex-wife was a great friend of the Clintons and had donated $450,000 to the Clinton Library and had made a lot of other donations to the Democratic Party. So that was one of the reasons why that pardon was investigated so thoroughly by Congress, because, you know, the question was, did the donations really cause the president to act as he had? I will also mention that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York undertook a pretty lengthy investigation into the circumstances of the granting of the pardon to determine whether there are any charges that could be brought. It was determined eventually, you know, that they wouldn't bring any charges. Nothing ever happened. But again, you know, he was a fugitive. The department's policy would have been, we think that he's not entitled to clemency, but the president trumps the department, and the president acted in that case.
I'd love to ask a follow-up question to that, right? Because you're talking about a congressional investigation that followed this pardon. What was the purpose of that investigation? Because if the pardon power is plenary, and there are a lot of questions around this now, what could Congress do?
Well, Congress has the inherent authority to investigate waste, fraud, and abuse. And I think that was the hook they used. The Congress really has very little ability to cabin a president's pardon power. You know, it can't pass statutes to limit how he exercises it. It can try to investigate it if it wants to, if it can find a legitimate legislative reason to do so. You know, the courts say that there needs to be a legitimate reason for the Congress to do that. You know, depending on the circumstances, rather broadly or narrowly construed. But, you know, the thing about the Clinton pardons was there were so many controversial ones that were granted on the last day. I mean, Mark Rich wasn't even the only one. There was a whole list of cases that Congress looked at that were on the president's list that last day. And basically the question was, were these in some way corrupt pardons? You know, there were questions of whether Hillary Rodham Clinton's brothers had sold access, essentially, had you know, represented people, had come in and asked the president to grant pardons to people that were paying them for their access to the president. You know, there were any number of cases that the Congress looked at. And I think the umbrella term was fraud and abuse of the power was what they were looking at, in part to look at, is there anything that can or should be done about it? But the bottom line is there really isn't much that they can do about it. If the president does something that Congress finds questionable, you know, they have the power of the purse, so they could zero out the pardon attorney's office, which would be bad for the process, but it wouldn't stop the president from doing what he wants to do, because he doesn't need the pardon attorney's office if he doesn't want it. There are limited opportunities for Congress to act.
Right. So let's take this to the, you know, the logical conclusion, right? Let's say that they had found rampant corruption because of the Clintons, that they had, you know, turned up evidence of pay for play, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there. So I suppose criminal charges could be brought against people that, you know, like offered the bribes, I suppose, is that what they were looking for?
Bribes or gratuities or something.
Sure. So the people who were bribing could be potentially prosecuted, but that doesn't disturb the pardon itself. Just to be clear,
no, that's exactly right. The pardon stands. I mean, I think part of what they were looking at is there any way that we can overturn these pardons? And the answer was decided to be no. There's nothing we can do. I mean, there was a lot of upset and a lot of grumbling. You know, and the Justice Department had to get up there, and lots of officials testified about what had happened and what hadn't happened. But, you know, in the end, the president's power or the pardon itself is something that can't be clawed back. It can't be undone by the next president. It stands. If there's criminality involved, you know, if the president had still been in office, impeachment could have been a remedy. But of course, the president was not then in office. You know, Elisa, you mentioned that, you know, it's pardon season because it's the end of the administration. That was not the typical way that the clemency power was exercised throughout history, except in the last several decades. Clinton was the first one that I know of that, you know, just went out with a raft of grants. And now everybody says, oh, it's pardon season because it's the end of the administration. But if the system is working well, grants are happening throughout the time that the president is in office. Part of the problem that modern day presidents have, though, is that they don't look at it as a regular housekeeping function of the presidency. It kind of gets short shrift and they don't think about it until they're close to the end of the term and they go, oh, I haven't done very many cases. You know, that sometimes then leads to, well, why don't I have more better cases? But, you know, you can't turn the ship on a dime. I mean, it's better when it functions throughout the administration and there's regular grants and regular denials. And everybody, you know, just recognizes that it's a regular function that should continue on. I know you wanted to talk about some other national security cases. Well, there are a number of cases involving Puerto Rican nationalists, people that are from the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico who, you know, strongly to the point of being violent about it, wanted to get people's support for granting them independence. And some of those cases go all the way back to the Truman administration. When Harry Truman was president, a person named Oscar Collazo tried to assassinate him. He came to Blair House and tried to kill President Truman, and he was convicted and sentenced to death, and then Truman commuted his sentence to life imprisonment, and then later on, you know, he was commuted further. Jimmy Carter commuted three other Puerto Rican nationalists who had engaged in an armed attack on the House of Representatives when it was in session in 1954, and he commuted their sentences after they'd served 25 years in 1979. George H.W. Bush's pardon of the Iran-Contra participants, of course, in December of 1992 was very controversial because Caspar Weinberger, who had been the former defense secretary under the Reagan administration, was about to go to trial in connection with the Iran-Contra affair. And the special counsel had said that he was going to, or was contemplating calling Bush as a witness in that case. When Bush pardoned the six Iran-Contra defendants, there was a great controversy over whether or not, you know, that had any overtones of, you know, protecting himself in doing that. That grant, we now know from what he has said, was supported by then Attorney General Bill Barr, and President Bush actually issued a very long statement about why he granted that pardon. So another Puerto Rican nationalist case in 1999, President Clinton offered clemency to 16 Puerto Rican nationalists who had been engaged in, when convicted of, seditious conspiracy and a variety of offenses. Their group had been involved in a number of terrorist bombings throughout the United States. None of them were actually convicted in the bombings, but the movement was quite violent. And President Clinton offered commutation to 16 of them. 14 of the defendant or the inmates accepted the grant. They had to, as part of that, had to agree to renounce violence and to not associate with other Puerto Rican nationalists until the natural expiration of their sentence. Again, Congress held long hearings about that as well. There was a concern or voiced by members of Congress that grant had been motivated in part by the desire to help Hillary Rodham Clinton's Senate campaign in New York. But there was a long hearing about that as well. One of the two people that rejected Clinton's commutation offer in 1999 was a man named Oscar Lopez Rivera. And in 2017, President Obama commuted his sentence. So this is a man who not only was offered commutation by one president, but was granted commutation by another. It's not so unusual to see someone who gets two commutations. If it's a death penalty case, for example, where, you know, someone had the death penalty and then he was commuted to life without parole, and then a later judge or a later president commuted the sentence of life without parole to a term of years. But as far as I know, Lopez Rivera is the only one who was offered clemency by a president, rejected it, and then got it from another president. So that's pretty unusual.
I think one thing that was very interesting recently, and I say recently because some of these really go back, in particular the Puerto Rican nationalist movement, which is obviously still active and was around for, at this point, decades, but was the commutation of the sentence of Scooter Libby.
Right.
I think that really had a lot of people asking questions at the time. But I do remember reading President George W. Bush's statement about that. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just because many of our listeners were, I wouldn't say cutting their second set of teeth when that occurred.
Right.
But they might like to know what that looked like. I mean, he was charged with leaking the identity of Valerie Plame, who was in a covert CIA agent, and for political purposes, really, at the time, to deflect from an editorial that had been written, or an opinion piece which had been written by her husband. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was sort of this one-off weird tertiary thing, which, interestingly enough, Nicole Wallace admitted in open court had been the brainchild of several people, and that she herself, though she's an MSNBC hostess now and could not be lovelier, that she had been part of the group trying to come up with a great idea to see what they could do to sort of take this guy on, who was Joe Wilson. But what happened there?
Well, the Libby was actually convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. It wasn't in the course of the leak investigation. And I think that there was, you know, he was Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. And, you know, the question was, who was it that gave this name out and to whom? Patrick Fitzgerald, who was the U.S. attorney in Chicago, he handled this prosecution. And Libby ultimately was convicted of perjury and obstruction rather than, you know, violating national security by leaking the name. Because he was, you know, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff and was the only person, as I believe, convicted in connection with this whole investigation, it was kind of a cause celeb. He was sentenced to a 30-month prison term by Judge Reggie Walton, and he was also, of course, had supervised release, and I believe a fine imposed as well. And from what we know now, I guess, you know, Vice President Cheney was livid about this whole thing and was lobbying heavily to get President Bush to commute his sentence. And so on July 2nd, 2007, President Bush did, in fact, commute his sentence, which was right before he was supposed to report to prison. So I believe he left intact the, I'm almost sure this is right. He left intact the fine and the supervised release, but he commuted the prison sentence so that he would not have to serve the prison time. Now, again, I can say this because it's a well-known fact, because there was another congressional hearing about it. That grant was done without the input of the pardon attorney's office, so we were not involved in it. Even though Congress was, some members of Congress anyway, we were infuriated by it, and they had a hearing, President obviously didn't have to answer anything about it to Congress because it's his power. And, you know, there was a hearing. I believe Joe Wilson testified. The pardon attorney was there basically to say, well, it didn't go through us. I don't know. I can't answer that question. And there were a couple of, law professors there who were opining on the pardon power. But, you know, that because of who he was and because of the whole contretemps over Ambassador Wilson and his wife and his wife's job, it became a very controversial case. I believe the president, right up to the day of President Obama's inauguration, I believe has said that in his book that, you know, Cheney was still agitating for a pardon for Scooter Libby, and he didn't feel that it was the appropriate thing to do, and he didn't do it. But in April, of course, of 2018, President Trump did pardon Scooter Libby, and you know, his reasons were his reasons, whatever they were. So again, this was a case where two presidents acted, you know, because of what they felt was the appropriate thing for them to do. And it's not, you know, it's an example of the power being plenary. He can do whatever he feels is appropriate.
So Helen, I'm going to defer to Yvette now because she has a burning question that I think so does the rest of America.
Okay. We're talking about controversial pardons, and I'm going to ask the $64,000 question that everyone is thinking about and why everybody tuned into this particular podcast. Can the president pardon himself? We have an unusual president that I don't think it's controversial to say has some criminal exposure, at least to a higher degree than what we've seen historically. And the president has openly mused about the ability to pardon himself. And so, can the president pardon himself?
The answer is nobody knows. And I guess we'll only find out if the president does it and then if it's litigated. No president, of course, has ever tried to pardon himself. And there is no case law on it. The pardon clause does not, in so many words itself, express, you know, say anything about it. Although there is an argument to be made, I suppose, and people are writing a lot of things about this. And one of the thoughts that people have is, well, the way the pardon clause reads, the president shall have the power to grant pardons and reprieves, which, you know, sets up the idea of one person giving and another person receiving. So can you grant something to yourself? It's, you know, it boggles the mind. One would say probably not, but the question has never been addressed. The Office of Legal Counsel in the White House very briefly, and I mean very briefly, addressed this question right before President Nixon resigned in an opinion, presidential or legislative pardon of the president. It was a quick request for what is the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion on this. And here's what the opinion says. It says, pursuant to Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment, is vested in the president. This raises the question of whether the president can pardon himself. Under the fundamental rule that no one may be a judge in his own case, it would seem that the question should be answered in the negative. Yes, and that's all it says. So logically, one would think not. The OLC opinion then goes on to talk about whether the necessity doctrine might be applicable, but obviously it's not here. Now, they did take on one other interesting issue that could come up in this. And that is, the office said, well, what the president might do, another approach to this could be under the 25th Amendment. If the president were to declare himself temporarily unable to perform his duties, the vice president would then become the acting president. As such, he could then pardon the president, and then the president could either resign or resume the duties of his office. So there was that idea, which I don't know that anybody's even thought about that one recently.
Well, they have now, Helen. Thanks so much.
But that, of course, would require that, you know, acting President Pence be willing to do that. Of course, you know, a president could be pardoned by his successor. I believe it's been said, at least I've read it, that President-elect Biden has indicated that he doesn't intend to pardon President Trump. And he's also said, though, that, you know, he wants to move on. So the real question is, can the president do it? Nobody knows. It would have, if he did give himself a pardon, grant himself a pardon, write up a piece of paper saying he pardons himself, in order to know the answer of whether that was valid, it would have to be litigated somehow. So if you know, a U.S. attorney were to charge him with a federal offense that occurred during his term, and the president then pleaded the pardon as a bar to the prosecution, then a court could decide that question. A pardon of by the president would not help him if he faces criminal charges in a state jurisdiction, because the president's pardon power does not extend to state offenses. It also would not be a bar to civil penalties for any conceivable, you know, tax offenses or other offenses, if there are any. I don't know. But it's a very fraught question. There are about as many viewpoints on it as there are people that like to talk about it. And the answer is we really don't know. I guess it was considered during the Clinton administration as well. But only in the Nixon and Clinton administrations, as far as I know, has the issue even been thought about before now. I'm not sure whether it was ever considered a real live issue then as it appears to be today. And the answer is we won't know unless he does it and unless he then has to put it to the test of litigation.
I would say it doesn't. I mean, listening to you talk about the history of pardons, though, I would note that there have been a lot of pardons that were issued in order to bring the country together, even including Confederate officials who,
right.
I mean, it would be hard to argue that they had done anything other than treason by seceding and taking up arms, you know, so on, and obviously violating what would now be, I guess, the Smith Act and so on. But
well, the very first pardon was done for purposes of, you know, bringing the country together. I mean, George Washington's pardon of the Whiskey Rebellion insurgents. I mean, that was a huge divisive point in the early days of our country. And two people had been convicted of treason and were to hang for murder for treason. And he decided that the right thing to do was to pardon these two who had, you know, done the to the nth degree to challenge the whiskey excise tax and sort of cool down the temperature and bring people together. So, you know, the pardon process does serve a very important purpose. Jimmy Carter's proclamation on his first day in office granting pardons to Military Selective Service Act violators who had not, you know, come to the Ford Clemency Board seeking clemency. He just did it by proclamation and pardoned them of their offenses as long as they were nonviolent and as long as they weren't employees of the Selective Service Administration. I mean, there have been a lot of acts the presidents make, you know, take to heal the country, to bring the country together. Even the Nixon pardon, you know, the motivation for that was Ford's desire to put this all behind us, move forward, and stop agonizing over Watergate. One other thing I'd like to say about clemency is that, you know, the sensational cases get a lot of attention, but the really best part of clemency is the regular people that apply for clemency who want the president's forgiveness or who seek a commutation of sentence for a good and legitimate reason. There's nothing better than seeing those people get granted clemency by the president. And I have to tell you, I think anybody who has ever worked in the pardon attorney's office will tell you that when those cases get granted and we get to call the person and tell them that they've been granted clemency, it is one of the best and most emotional experiences a person can ever have. I mean, I've had people break down in tears on the other end of the phone when I tell them that the president has granted them a pardon. It's just, it's what the process was meant to do. It's meant to be healing. It's meant to be, you know, forgiving. It's meant to bring out the best in people who have, you know, gone astray perhaps and now have come back and want to make something of themselves, want to start over, whether it's by, you know, getting out of prison and starting a new life or whether it's by, you know, getting a pardon and moving on with their lives. It's really an important process, and it's a great power that the president has. And you know, the controversial cases really shouldn't overshadow that.
That's an excellent point. We do often have sort of the anecdote now beginning to inform policies going forward. So I do want to thank you, Helen. This has been really kind of incredible. And we've talked a little bit about what little really there isn't anything that the Congress can do to constrain that, because obviously there's a separation of powers.
Right.
It'll be interesting to watch to see whether or not there is any effort by the president. And I don't want by anything I'm saying to suggest that I think he would need to do that. But to see whether or not he would try to grant himself some sort of reprieve from any future federal case. I think that maybe one of the things that's interesting is looking back as far as the Whiskey Rebellion. I suppose there's some risk, as there would be in a pardoning of Trump by a President Biden, if that were ever needed, and it may not be, but if it were, because President Trump has indicated he would run again, and whether right. that sort of thing would be in the back of the mind of anyone who would or would not grant a pardon. So
right. That's true.
I am so glad that, well, and it's been so great talking to you. It's so great to have this historical context. And we hope that you'll come back someday after we've heard about this pardon process, because it is, you make an excellent point about pardon season being perhaps occasioned by the press of other work, that it's stacked up until the last minute. But this year, obviously, there's been a lot of last minute things like COVID-19.
Right.
So maybe that won't happen, but maybe it will. I guess we'll wait to see. Thank you, Helen.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I just say the pardon attorney's office is working every day, all day. You know, I mean, they're processing cases, COVID or not, whether there's final action or not, they're processing cases all the time. And that's what their whole reason for living is. So that's why they're there.
That's awesome. Once again, you know, these career professionals that are really devoted right. to the work are gems.
Right.
Thank you very much for listening. You can share this episode with a friend and discuss any of the topics that we've raised in this news roundup in a thoughtful way. Remember that it's important to hear other people's opinions and even their arguments. It will improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security, despite everything that's going on, is our unity. We are a country more diverse in thought than any other. Our producer and writer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. And my other producer is the ever amazing Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.